Hello everyone, I'm Brianna Breslin.
And I'm Dia Sharma.
Welcome to Yana LV, where we're on a mission to normalize mental health discussions and foster a supportive community. Yana stands for You Are Not Alone, and that's exactly what the show is all about. Here in the Lehigh Valley and beyond, we're breaking barriers and challenging the stigma surrounding mental health. Through candid conversations, expert insights, and personal stories, we're exploring the highs and lows of mental health and well-being altogether.
Today, we're thrilled to be joined by our guest, Maggie. Maggie has been with NAMI, which stands for National Alliance on Mental Illness, Lehigh Valley, for 8 years. Her nonprofit experience prior to becoming involved in the mental health field includes 20 years in hospice and end-of-life care. Earlier, she worked for two management consulting firms in the Boston area, focusing on senior management education programs for executives across the country and in Europe. Maggie also serves as board member of Equilibrium, a therapeutic writing center, where she is also a volunteer leader. Founded in 1983, NAMI Lehigh Valley's mission is to improve the quality of life for individuals living with mental illness and for their family members through education, support, and removing the stigma that surrounds mental illness. NAMI is the largest grassroots organization in the country focused on mental health, and NAMI LV is one of more than 700 affiliates across the country. So, Maggie, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be here.
We are too. So, what inspired you to join NAMI Lehigh Valley 8 years ago?
Well, I was looking for a break from what I had been doing, and I live with anxiety and depression, so I understood some of the struggles that people are facing. And I realized that a lot of the issues between end-of-life care and good mental health care are the same, in that it involves a team, it's both the patient and the family, it's the unit of care, it's not something that everybody wants to talk about. There's still a stigma around it, of course, that we're working on. And so it was very similar, and it was easy to step into.
Yes, I agree with you what you said, that there's a lot of stigma around mental health, and it's very important to address that to make the next steps.
Right.
So how has NAMI Lehigh Valley evolved since you started working there?
We are growing by leaps and bounds right now. When I started about 8 years ago, there was one full-time employee and one part-time employee. We now have a paid staff of 5, but we're still very volunteer-driven. Mm-hmm. Volunteers lead all of our programming. They represent us in the community. They often do things like this if I'm not available. So we're really fortunate to have them.
Yeah. Yeah, volunteers are great. I think Dee and I actually volunteered for NAMI for 5K
or 10K. Oh, of course. Yeah.
So, great. Yeah, volunteering is always great. So, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Good.
And we got to like know more about the organization, and also because we're both interested in mental health. So.
Yeah, wonderful. Yeah. Well, you'll have to come volunteer again.
Yes, we will. So, what are some of the key programs or initiatives NAMI offers to support individuals and families?
Mm-hmm. We have two main groups of activities that we do. The first is our support groups, and these groups meet once a week. We have one for peers, individuals who are living with a mental illness, and one for family members. And we define family really broadly, family members, friends, anybody who cares for or about someone with mental illness is very welcome. The peer group right now is still meeting by Zoom because that's what they told us they wanted to because it's more convenient. And for somebody who hasn't been to a group before, it's just a little easier. There's that little bit of distance that you don't have live until people get comfortable. Family, same thing. All of our programming is led by people who have similar lived experience. So our peer programs are led by trained peers. Our family programs are led by trained family members.
Yeah.
And the other thing we do are education courses. And those are 8-week courses, usually meet one evening a week, and they cover all aspects of mental illness. And they're especially helpful for people who either have or know someone who has a new diagnosis.
I think like the education program that you talked about is so important because not many people know about mental health or even a little bit about it, and they just make conclusions to it. So having the understanding and learning about it will help like break the stigma around it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that's why we welcome opportunities like being here today. And we try to do a lot of community education. NAMI National has programs for schools, for workplaces. We're working a lot with law enforcement right now through crisis intervention team training to help law enforcement officers interact with people who may be experiencing a mental health crisis.
So how does NAMI Lehigh Valley work to reduce the stigma surrounding mental health illness?
Research shows that one of the best ways to reduce the stigma is for people to have contact with somebody who's living with a mental illness. Mm-hmm. And if that can't be live, even video works. So we have a number of people who have very generously told their stories of hope and recovery, and we have videos of those that we can use. And we usually have a peer or family member go with a staff member to any community presentations that we're doing, because once we've shown people that this is something, mental illness is something that affects everybody, and there is a range of severity. And so once people see that, they start getting more comfortable with it and think, well, wait, that person that I thought was always happy and cheery is actually living with depression.
Yeah. I think what you said, like, really resonated with me, because that's another reason Bronna and I started this podcast, was to, like, spread the word. And also, because if you interact with someone or share someone's story about how they have faced mental health and how everyone has mental health, it like shows that it's just not like something that is secluded, but everyone deals with it.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like that is so true. Like, there are so many individuals that I know that it's like they seem so happy, they're so bubbly, and then you really get to know them and then they open up to you, and it's you find out really how sad they really do feel and how they just don't really express that to other people. So I think that is so like, I think that's so important to realize, is that it really is. Like, I feel like the happiest people sometimes.
And and I think your generation is really leading the way on that education and acceptance. And, you know, it's so true what you're saying, because one metaphor I've heard people use is that for very often for people who are living with a mental illness, particularly mood disorders like anxiety or depression, they're like a duck. If you just watch them swimming across a pond, everything's smooth and even and tranquil. And right underneath the surface, they are pedaling as fast as they can to stay afloat.
Yeah. Yeah, like Bronna said, like, sometimes you think someone's, like, happy and jovial and everything's fine, but in reality, they're facing something, but they can't express that.
Right.
So what are some common misconceptions about mental health that you frequently encounter?
That's a really good question. There are a lot of them. I think one of the biggest ones is that mental illness is one thing. And very often people just think of some of the more severe disorders like schizophrenia. And it's really just like physical health in that there's a spectrum of mental health. And on one end of that spectrum or continuum, you would have the people who almost never get a cold or anything. They're really very healthy. On the other end, you might have someone who has a severe life-limiting illness. Most of us fall in between. We might have an acute episode of a physical illness, gets treated, we recover, it never happens again. We might have a chronic physical illness, something like diabetes or heart disease, that has to be treated and managed. But if you follow the care program, it doesn't really interfere with your life that much. Mental health is exactly the same. You can have one episode of it. It can be something that does have to be managed over a lifetime. But it's not just one thing. It really is a range.
Mm-hmm. I think, as you said, so many people have that misconception that mental health is like the complete extreme. Mm-hmm. But in reality, it's like everything else, that there's like a range. It's like from like least to like the most. And most people like fall in between.
Right. So. Mm-hmm. And we're so lucky these days, because there are so many innovative treatments that are coming up that are really effective, in addition to the things we already know are effective, like medications, talk therapy, counseling, etc.
Yeah. And I feel like it is really important. Like, I feel like the first step is really recognition. Then once you realize that there is a spectrum, I feel like it's so much easier to move forward and just really communicate with other people.
Yep, I think that's right.
Yeah.
So how has the conversation around mental health changed over the years, would you say?
I think there's a lot more acceptance than there had been, and fewer myths and misconceptions. We are still working on it. And we're working, you know, as I said, with a variety of groups, ranging from faith communities to churches to law enforcement, because people are really welcoming that information now. And it's estimated that 1 in 5 American adults experience an episode of mental illness in a given year. So this is something that touches everybody. Everyone knows someone who is living with some sort of mental health disorder, whether they realize it or not. So I think there is an openness to that conversation, and I think the language is changing around it. I mean, we have bigger problems to solve than some of the language, but a lot of the language has been hurtful. And I think one of the good changes in conversations has been that it's changing to what we call person-centric language, so that instead of saying she's schizophrenic, we will say she is living with schizophrenia, because a disease does not define the individual.
I feel like, I do think 100% how mental health is getting a lot more talked about. Mm-hmm. Obviously, yes, we do need more work on it, but on recognition. But even my parents, like when I told them I was interested in learning about mental health and how I was doing this podcast with Dia, they're like, really? Like, that's talked about? Like, I feel like even like when they were younger, which was like 40 years ago, it's they weren't really used to talking about it. So I think that's, it just shows me, even in my family, like even in my family, I've seen how much it's changed over the years, which I think is so
good. Good. Yeah, yeah. That's great to hear.
Yeah.
And you also said that like our generation is talking about it more, which I agree. I think like before, as Bronna said, it wasn't much like talked about.
Right.
But now like there's the stigmas breaking around it. And like even if it's getting better, obviously there's like more ways that we can make it even better. There's like growth.
Sure.
Like room for improvement.
Yeah.
But I think the idea, especially that you said about language, like makes a big difference because language is like the way we communicate to each other, the way we like express.
Exactly.
So what challenges do you think that individuals with mental illness and their families face most often?
I think there are a couple big ones. One is that stigma still exists, and it does get in the way sometimes. The other is access to care. So there is a shortage of mental health providers now all across the system, ranging from people who are companions and aides to people living with mental illness, all the way through psychiatrists and anyone in between. So unfortunately, there are often long waits for appointments, and it can be difficult for people to get the support that they need to be able to live in the community. And NAMI would never try to replace licensed or credentialed providers. That's not at all what we're doing. But if someone's waiting to have an appointment or sorting through some of those issues with getting access to that care, our support groups and education programs can be tremendously helpful. Because one thing that people tell us all the time is it's just helpful to know that they're not alone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Other people are going through the same thing.
Also, hence our podcast name, You Are Not Alone.
Exactly, yeah. which is one of NAMI's taglines.
Yeah, because then understanding that, like, there's a community that also understands what you're going through makes it a little easier to
definitely
every single day.
And
definitely.
I feel like even understanding how it's even, because I'll say we're pretty young, like, Dia and I, we're 17 years old. Like, I feel like it's so important to recognize how you can be as young as us, or you can even be 10 years old or even younger, and just understanding really, I feel like that, too, it's, like, a range of community. It's such, like, the age range. It's just, like, 1 to 100, honestly, like,
it's very true.
Kind of thing. Like, and I feel like that's so important to understand you are not alone, because, you know, it's so many different ages that I feel like that's so important to realize that. What are some of the biggest barriers to mental health care access in the Lehigh Valley?
A lot of it comes from lack of funding. In theory, there's now parity between insurance, health insurance coverage for physical care and mental health care. It doesn't get enforced. So a lot of people don't have the kind of health insurance that allows them to access that mental care. And there are still, you know, some people still are affected by that stigma. They think, you know, oh, if I go to the doctor, I'm going to get labeled as something. And there are also still some cultural differences around mental health. Some people, there are some cultures who still believe, you know, this is something you tough it out and you rely on family. You don't talk about it outside the family. And that's how you manage it.
Like, again, kind of the touch on that, like, that's how my grandfather was, like, my parents' parents, like, they're very strict on, and like, they would tell me that, my parents would tell me that, how their parents were so strict on, do not tell anyone, like, this is your own thing. Just keep working every day, you'll forget about it. I mean, if you have that mentality, like, it's just going to keep building up and building up, like, how you feel on the inside and how you truly feel. Right. And I feel like eventually then it's going to get to a point where it's just, like, it just keeps getting harder and harder, you know? It's like a heavier rock on your shoulder, and it just turns into a boulder, you know?
Exactly. And why not seek help?
Exactly.
Even if you have to wait for it.
Exactly, yeah. We're going to take a short break. We're talking with our guest, Maggie, from NAMI, about NAMI and the correlation of mental health and really what NAMI is here on Yana LV. Stay tuned and we'll be right back.
WDIY presents a selection of award-winning podcasts that air weeknights from 6 to 7 p.m. Listen to important conversations regarding art, science, business, health, and more here in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Check our website for new topics and archived programs. WDIY podcasts are on 88.1 FM, streaming at wdiy.org, on the app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Yana LV. And now we'll continue our conversation about NAMI, mental health, and now anxiety. So are there any upcoming initiatives or goals NAMI LV is working towards?
One of the things that we're spending a lot of time focused on right now is reaching out to underserved communities, whether that be different age groups or ethnic and racial groups. But a lot of groups, sometimes because of culture, sometimes because they haven't had access, haven't been able to get good mental health care. And so we're trying to change that.
Yeah, I think that taking that next step is very important, especially because people who don't have that privilege or that much access don't get to progress towards like better like mental health care, and giving that them that opportunity is very important for them. So I think that's very, very cool.
Yeah.
Good. We do too.
So what are some common or the most common misconceptions about people with anxiety or about anxiety just in general?
I think one is that anxiety isn't normal. And a lot of anxiety is normal. I mean, if you're feeling anxiety about an upcoming test or something at work or a family issue, that's something everybody experiences sometimes. But if you're experiencing anxiety that's really keeping you from doing things that you would ordinarily enjoy or doing daily activities like going to school or going to work, and generally, if those symptoms continue for 2 weeks or more in a serious way, then we suggest that people start to seek out treatment for it.
Yeah.
And the other thing is people think the only way anxiety can go away is if they take anti-anxiety medications. And those can be incredibly helpful for some people. But there are a lot of other approaches, too, that work very effectively with anxiety.
Definitely, because my freshman year, I would say I struggled with anxiety a lot, especially like the transition from like middle school to high school and just an increase in workload and then also family stuff. It's you know, it's hard to balance. And then I realized medication wasn't the proper route for me. But I know, like, for some people, like some of my friends, they're on medication. Yeah. It helps them so much. But I realized, you know, for me, it was just writing, doing simple things like writing in my journal at night or just talking to my dad, honestly. Yeah. Like, and I just realized that was a better solution. So I feel like, yeah, recognizing, you know, it's not just medication. Because I feel like even at my school, I've heard, oh, like, the only way to really treat it is just medication. And I feel like, yes, again, like how you said, it's helpful, but it's definitely not the only way.
Yeah, we always think that there are a whole different set of routes to recovery from mental health or mental illness, rather. And, you know, it's a different collection of activities for each person. It is, for some people, medication is helpful. Some people, mindless activities are incredibly useful for them. Someone, as you said, sometimes can benefit most from talking to someone.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we find really works effectively, which is why we do support groups, is just people being together, making connections.
Exactly,
just that alone can reduce anxiety.
So what are the key differences between everyday anxiety and an anxiety disorder?
The key differences would be that the anxiety disorder would really interfere with your life. Like if you're feeling, you know, sort of palm sweating, a little nauseous, nervous about doing something, that kind of anxiety, usually people can push through and continue to do what they need to get done. But anxiety can also be completely debilitating. And if it can get to, when it gets to a point where you can't do what you want to do and you can't, you just can't make yourself go to school or go to work and you don't want to pursue hobbies, then that's something that you really should seek treatment for.
Yeah.
So how does chronic anxiety affect the brain and the body over time?
Another good question. It actually physiologically can change the brain, and it can lead to all sorts of physical manifestations. Some of the more common ones people think of are headaches, digestive issues, sleep issues. It can affect your mood in other ways. Anxiety can lead to depression. And so we have to be very mindful there of that mind-body connection because it can lead to chronic illnesses.
Yeah, I think what you talked about specifically the mind-body connection is so real and interesting because, like, we don't think our brain affects us as much as we do, but I think it's, like, basically, like, the power of our whole body, and then it, like, responds to different things.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So how do social and environmental factors contribute to the rise of anxiety disorders?
Well, of course, one thing that everyone's talking about now is social media and its impact on youth.
Yeah.
And I think, yes, on one hand, it certainly adds a tremendous amount of pressure. When I went to school, if if I wasn't getting along with friends at school or getting bullied, I could go home and it stopped, at least until the next day. And now, because there's 24-hour access, and of course everybody's perfect on social media, it adds that kind of pressure. At the same time, I think for some people who are isolated, it can be a connection. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's entirely a bad thing.
Yeah.
But I think it's tough on the younger generation, and there is, of course, a lot going on in the world right now that has an influence on how people are feeling as well.
As you said, I think social media has its positives and negatives. Mm-hmm. And like on the positives, with someone who's feeling more isolated or if they're going through something, like through text, you can like reach out to a friend or call them and be like, hey, are you okay?
Right.
And sometimes you don't really want to say that at school or like in a public place, because sometimes you can't ask someone like in a public scenario because you don't want to embarrass them or like it's a personal thing.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then on the other hand, sometimes social media can be more negative because then you start comparing yourselves with other people, like looks, like, you know, if they're doing something and you feel left out. So it's both. Like it depends. Just a balance.
Definitely. So, definitely. Yeah.
And again, I feel like it's that idea that everyone is so different and, you know, like in our own ways, like, again, either some things benefit us, some things don't. So for me, it's always like a mix. It's like there are days and I'm like, okay, this is nice, like to see what people are doing. And then it's the other day, I don't know, it's like then it's like I get so not as much anymore. I'm trying to practice not doing that and like going outside and stuff more. But I remember like over the summer when I just like, when I wasn't working, I would just scroll on my phone for so long and I would just like, then I just wouldn't want to get out of my room, and I would just sit there, like, on my phone watching TikTok. You know, and then I feel like then once someone gets used to that, or, like, when I got used to that, I just, like, was like, oh, I don't want to go to school now. Like, I just want to sit in my bed. And I feel like, so, but again, it's, like, a different effect. Like, how would you say it was with you?
Yeah. It's, like, more, like, I feel like if you have a balance, obviously, like, in everything that you do, it's better. Because I agree with you, Ronald. Like, sometimes I'm like, oh, like, this is nice. Like, I can, like, talk to my friends. I can, like, look at these, like, reels or, like, TikToks.
Right.
But then on the other hand, like, sometimes, like, on Instagram especially, like, people are, like, posting what they're doing, where they're going on vacation, like, how they, like, look really good in that picture. And you're like, why don't I look like that? Why can't, like, you know? So just, like,
So, yeah, it's just about being careful, being cautious, I think, for sure. Because it can be a trap if you make it, you know? So,
for sure.
Yeah.
I think you mentioned this before, but could you explain more about the connection between anxiety and other mental health conditions, specifically depression?
Sure. Anxiety can lead to depression. Depression can lead to anxiety. Very often they exist together. People like me very often have a diagnosis that includes both of them. And, you know, as you were saying earlier, nothing in our bodies and minds happens in isolation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's one big system.
Yeah.
And it's all connected. So I think we have to be, as a result, really aware of what's happening with us, how we're feeling, you know. And and are we feeling sadness, for example, because of something specific? Or is it just that feeling of, you know, sort of doom and gloom and not feeling any better and nothing's really enjoyable?
Yeah. I didn't realize this much before, but, like, as we're more talking about it and, like, over the years, I've realized how much of a connection there is between our mind and body. For example, like, I remember in my 10th grade year, I was going through a lot of stress and anxiety, and I realized it was taking tolls on my body. I couldn't sleep. I was getting really tired. I was getting constant headaches. I was getting really jittery and, like, really anxious. And then I realized that it was because of, like, my stress overload and my anxiety. And then I realized, like, some, like, not coping, but, like, how to, like, counteract that, like go outside, take a break, just like take some couple deep breaths and just like, so.
Yeah, you're right. And that's why so many of those activities, particularly breathing activities, can be so helpful. I mean, I have to admit, when I started this line of work, I was really skeptical and I thought, you know, I'm having terrible anxiety. How is breathing going to help?
Yeah.
But somebody talked me into trying it and it really, the breathing exercises, like the box breathing, breathe in, hold, exhale, hold.
Yeah.
You know, things like that really make a difference. Your body responds to those and starts to bring the temperature down.
Even like distracting your mind sometimes. Like I specifically remember a vivid memory I had like this past, like a couple months ago actually. I was having a really bad panic attack.
Oh.
And I called one of my friends because I know she struggles with it too.
Yeah.
And she like heard me hyperventilating on the phone and I was like crying. And then she just asked me questions like, oh, like name five things around you. Like say the alphabet, take five deep breaths. Yep. And then finally when I was calm, I could finally like explain it. But I thought that was really, really helpful. So.
Yeah, that's one thing we say to people a lot. You know, name five things you can see, four things you can hear, three things you can taste, etc.
And it's so helpful because it distracts you, and then you kind of feel like you can take a step back away from all that anxious pressure and just like focus on like the present moment.
That's right.
I know. I think breathing's so helpful. Like, even before I sleep, even if just like I'm not even stressed out, it's just like make me relax even more. Mm-hmm. Like, I do, like, honestly, almost every night before I sleep, I just take, like, three big breaths, breathe in, breathe out. And I honestly, I've seen such a difference. Like, I think I just sleep better. I didn't really realize. Like, I always thought, yeah, maybe it's, like, a little, like, I was like, I don't know about this. Like,
right.
I don't know, it's just breathing. I don't know, I just feel like once you get in the habit of it, and, like, you do it at least, like, once a day, or, like, it becomes habit, like I said. It just, it does help. Like, it helps you relax. It just, even when you're not as tense, it really calms you down.
Definitely.
So how has research on anxiety evolved in recent years, and what breakthroughs have been made?
You know, it's something that we're still learning about. Mm-hmm. And new treatments, both for anxiety and depression, are coming along really quickly now. For example, this is more depression than anxiety, but they're having incredible results with ketamine, the drug, and finding that it reduces suicidal ideation in 24 hours. And so something like that's been incredibly helpful. The transcranial magnetic stimulation, which involves wearing sort of a helmet and it taps.
Yeah, we're talking about,
People have had remarkable results with that for both anxiety and depression that's been resistant to treatment. And there are other forms of tapping that people are finding actually works. So the research is coming along, but there's still more needed.
Wow, I did not know about like ketamine and like the thing that you just said. That's really fascinating.
Yeah.
And I think also another fact about it is that as it's being more talked about, more people like are understanding like maybe what could be done to like as a solution. So
That's true too.
Yeah, I like in my English class. So honestly, I feel like it had to do a lot with mental health because it's about like recognizing nature and then how we're similar to nature and really how to appreciate it and just be more connected with it. And so we watched this documentary, and it was about, like, I'm not trying to, people who are listening, I'm not saying to do this, but it was a whole documentary, we watched it for, like, over a month, like, about taking shrooms, I guess, and that's what it made me think of ketamine, like, having a shroom, but then they were, like, and then they would have, like, this, like, life-changing experience, like, it was someone who was so stressed, and then, like, and I had no idea about that, I had no idea that it could just... So that's why it reminded me of ketamine. So,
they're certainly looking into that. And you said another thing about just being outdoors and in nature and relating to nature. And you had mentioned it earlier, too.
Yeah.
That is so helpful.
Yeah.
And just to make sure everybody understands, I am not suggesting by any means that people go out and take ketamine to treat anxiety and depression. This is prescribed and supervised by a doctor.
Okay. Yes, exactly.
So how can community members support NAMI's mission and those struggling with mental illness?
We are always looking for more volunteers because all of our programming is volunteer-led.
Yes.
And the only real requirement is that somebody has similar lived experience.
Okay.
So that they're either an individual living with a mental illness or a family member. And then NAMI provides training. It's usually a week, and over the course of a weekend, it's usually Zoom. And then people are equipped to either lead our programs or go out and talk in the community. Always welcome volunteers for that. And you had mentioned earlier that you both volunteered at our 5K and walk.
Yeah.
We always need volunteers for that event that'll be in September and for our community spaghetti dinner that is probably going to be in April. We're always looking for servers for that as well. But, you know, just anybody who's willing to help spread the word about mental illness and mental health, we welcome their participation.
Yeah. So I do believe that is all the time we have today. Thank you so much, Maggie, for joining us this evening.
Oh, thanks to both of you. I really enjoyed it.
And thank you, listeners, for tuning in. You can find past episodes at WDIY.org, on the WDIY app, and on other major podcast platforms. I'm Bronna Breslin.
I'm Dia Sharma.
And this is WDIY 88.1. We'll see you next time on YanaLV, and remember that you are not alone.